Throughout the early childhood years, there are opportunities for every child's potential to blossom and for a lifelong love of learning to begin. Welcome to Lilio. Our solutions for center management, family engagement, teaching and learning, and professional development have impacted countless educators, children, and families. We stand as a symbol of quality and commitment to early childhood education, with the belief that early educators have the power to change children's lives and ultimately the world. Lilio, the building blocks for high-quality childcare. Learn more at www.lilio.com.
Hey everyone, it's David Duchovny. Do you ever feel like a failure? Trust me, I get it. Hell, I've spent my whole life almost feeling like a failure. It's appropriate, though, because on Fail Better, my new podcast with Lemonada Media, exploring the world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives, is the whole point. Each week, I'll chat with artists, athletes, actors, and experts about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, I hope we can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out on May 7th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
I'm Kiki Monique, and this is I'm Sorry, a podcast about apologies. And this week, I slept in my bed, not my couch, every single day this week.
Oh, wow. And this is Mohanad Sheikhi, and I'm excited to talk about Elizabeth today. Not Holmes, but the Queen. Where is she? Is she dead? Is she alive? I still believe that she's dead, and all of these videos of her are pre-recorded, so we'll see.
And my name is Oha Lopez, and this week I was a master of disguise because I Febrezed my whole house just to keep it tight. Open all the windows, Febrezed everything. And I like the scent of, you know, Fabric Heavy Duty 2X Odor Elimination Powder all over my house.
Smells clean.
Yeah, I just really like it more than a candle. I can't help myself. Mm. Hello, everybody, and welcome to I'm Sorry. We are so excited to be here together again. Today, we are going to talk about Elizabeth Ann Holmes. But first, we do have a quick announcement. So Lemonada Media, which is the company behind our show, has a new series that we are so excited to support. It is a podcast called After 1954. And they explore what happened after the historic ruling of Brown versus Board and talk about desegregation. But also, did you know that 38,000 Black educators lost their jobs in the wake of the 1954 ruling? And I didn't until I heard this timely and moving five-part series. So I definitely encourage you to check out After 1954 wherever you get your podcasts. I'm so excited for everybody to listen to it.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely did not learn about this in my public education schooling.
Yeah.
So now I have to learn everything through podcasts and TikTok.
Yeah, I'm very excited. And now to talk about a rich white lady.
Which I did learn a lot about in my public education school.
Yeah, learned too much about.
Yep. Yeah, we love this archetype. So, I mean, I've heard so much about Elizabeth Ann Holmes over the course of like the last 2 to 3 years. So, And there's so much media about her. So Elizabeth Ann Holmes is born in 1984 in Washington, D.C., so she's a nice, thick millennial. You know what I mean? She's like, she is, Mona's laughing. He's like, why thick? Why? I don't mean that she as a person is thick. I mean, she's born in the thick of it, you know?
Okay.
In the thick of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's growing up with like Steve Jobs and all these people. And she's born in Washington, D.C. And her father, which, wait for this name, Christian Rasmus Holmes IV. That's his full name, which, you know, that doesn't quite, you know, give off the like blue collar vibes that, say, a Chrissy Teigen Porky's backdrop gives us, you know. But he was a VP at Enron, which this is definitely, you know, talked about in the TV show, in the new biopic. But he's working for an energy company that later goes bankrupt. I don't know if you heard of that little accounting fraud scandal.
Oh, yeah. Enron.
Just a little snafu. And then her mother, Noelle Ann, worked as a congressional committee staffer. So both of them held pretty executive positions in government agencies like the EPA, the USTDA. But again, basically the idea is they're both like actually very well-connected people. Mm-hmm. And then her grandparents and her great-grandparents are the mayor of Cincinnati from 1900 to 905 and an entrepreneur. So it's like she's coming down from a line of rich white ladies and rich white dudes, which I think she sort of acts like in a lot of ways. So she goes to high school in St. John's School in Houston, which guess what is where I just lived for a decade. And I lived four blocks away from this high school. You know, another person who also went to this high school, Wes Anderson.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
So this is like a lot of lives are coming into connection here. But this is also the setting for Rushmore Academy, which is like the Rushmore movie, that Wes Anderson. So he went back to his alma mater and that's where that movie was shot. That's just my a small fact here for no reason. And then, you know, during high school, she's interested in computer programming and she starts kind of her first business selling C++ compilers to Chinese universities. So she's already like, she's got it. She kind of knows what she wants to do.
Yeah.
And then after that, she begins attending, you know, Stanford University. So Stanford, it's a really interesting place for her in particular because she's studying chemical engineering and she's working as a student researcher. But Stanford has kind of like a history of supporting people who have patents and different ideas. And so if you connect with professors, they also have connections in terms of patent applications. And then Stanford School of Engineering ended up, one of the professors of Stanford School of Engineering ended up supporting her endeavor. So then she later kind of, you know, created Theranos. But I mean, at the end of her freshman year, Elizabeth worked at the Genome Institute of Singapore and basically was working with the SARS COVID virus. So this is, or the COV car, it's kind of like the first iteration of the SARS virus. So that's just an interesting tidbit for her too. So she filed her first patent application on the wearable drug delivery patch. And that's a little bit of what we see in the show. So, I mean, I guess when I was that age, I just didn't have these grand ideas. Like, did you guys have this big idea of what you were going to do with your life when you were 19?
Well, I think like so much of like what I appreciate about like the series and the podcast and all of the things that go into it is she came from such a storied background, like a legacy, right? Like you talked about like her family was, you know, the mayor, but like also she came from the Fleischmann's yeast, you know, became big again during quarantine because everyone was making bread, right? But I remember thinking about yeast. Fleischmann's was the only yeast I thought existed.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, that money didn't make it to her because I don't know if they blew it or whatever happened. But like, happened. That is her heritage. And so I think just in her head, she just knows that she needs to be this great as well. Because I imagine that she's probably told stories all her life growing up of like, oh, your great grandfather did this and, you know, your grandpa did this, you know. And so I think that's probably why she just had these great expectations.
Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, like seeing your dad lose his job and having to go and ask money from other people and all of that stuff. I understand the mentality of just being like, I will make something and I will never like let my dad, let my family like get to that level again. I want to be able to provide and all of that stuff. So like I get that angle. I get like where she's like coming from. But like I feel like sometimes, you know, like you do something and like you have like these great expectations, but then it doesn't work the way you want it, but you're just like double down on it because you're too embarrassed to fail at that point.
Yeah. And you have all these expectations of yourself and comparing yourself. I mean, like, I can't, it's almost like you're walking all the way to the peak of a mountain and you know you're going to have to come back down. You know you're going to have to throw yourself off of it. And the further up you go, the harder you're going to fall.
Absolutely.
And it definitely seems like this is something that her family history sort of primes her for in a way. She's very much like a, if you can see it, you can be it kind of person. And she done seen it. Like, she's seen people be extremely successful around her. And that inspires her to think really, really big, which is, I think, a great quality in a human being. And like, we are in an era of like, what is your vision? Like, how can you change the world? And she keeps kind of focusing on that, even at this point in her life. And so it seems like it's a really good priming situation for what's to come.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that's like ingrained in a lot of people, because you keep hearing all of these like specific stories about like people who no one believed in, and they just like went against the current and they did what they wanted and did not listen to people who are like doubting them and eventually succeeded. But, you know, sometimes like people don't understand, like sometimes you should listen to feedback and you're doing something wrong. It's not like, not everyone is a hater, basically. Sometimes you're way like over your head and you're not, you don't know what you're doing, which is why I always say that we need more people to have imposter syndrome. I think,
I think
we need that. Like, people like, we should get rid of, like, nope, we need more people with imposter syndrome, because a lot of the wrong people really believe in themselves, and we don't need that. We need to stop it.
Yeah, I definitely think Elizabeth Holden is a very clear, is a clear person who maybe should have doubted herself a couple times a little
exactly.
bit more.
Absolutely.
It's so weird because we're telling women not to do it. We're like, go get it. You can do it. But yeah, my favorite thing about real equality is Elizabeth Holmes being able to get to that point and even get that level of support and money to then defraud a bunch of people. I'm like, go women, we can do anything at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting to me. And as I was reading a couple of quotes from the Bad Blood book, which is, and forgive me, I have never heard his name spoken out loud. It's John Carreyrou. Carreyrou. Okay. Where, you know, he talks a little bit about whether or not she could be considered a sociopath. Mm. And, you know, while we're not going to diagnose her, really, there's clearly a moral compass that is really, you know, badly off kilter. And, you know, while he's not going to sort of, again, diagnose her, he really thinks that she has some sociopathic qualities. And so I wonder if, you know, in Stanford, she's in this time of her life where that's really kind of starting to pop up with for her.
Well, I think that was interesting, because I think he's the same one that referred to her when he was talking about Bernie Madoff, or maybe it was another guy, but I thought it was him.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, there were some similarities between the two. They were both smart, charming bullies. Which I thought was really interesting because, you know, again, in her childhood, it talks about how she had been bullied. And so it's interesting that she became the bully. And it's so interesting that so many of the things that she did, she became, you know, the female version of Steve Jobs and all of these things. Like, did she just want to become a facsimile of all of these people that affected her in some way? And I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what she wanted. And it's just like, kind of like forgetting that a lot of these people are not good themselves. They are, like, these are not people that you want to model yourselves after. Like, looking at like Mark Zuckerberg and like imagine being like, this is who I want to be. Absolutely not. Never.
You're totally right. It takes a really special kind of person to look at Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg and be like, that's what I would love to model myself after. Because in essence, they sort of represent, but I will say they represent huge, huge change in terms of like societal advancement. And so I think focusing on that part and not necessarily whether or not they're well-adjusted, happy people. I was reading an kind of like an Inc., an old INC, you know, she was on the cover of that kind of when the revamp of Theranos happened. But they were talking a little bit about kind of her day-to-day life and just the fact that, you know, that she was like notoriously secretive, that she didn't have time for novels or friends, didn't date, doesn't own a television, hasn't taken a vacation in 10 years. It's like what capitalism wants us all to be personified, you know?
Yeah, and people like, you know, glorify that. Like, you see so many articles about like how Steve Jobs and like Tim Cook and all of these people like wake up at like like 4 a.m.
They sleep 2.5 hours and like...
Exactly. And you do all of these things and like you have to wake up before the stock market is open or shit like that. And it's just like, what a fucking bunch of psychos.
Yes, it's that's exactly it.
Like humans are not supposed to live this way.
That's exactly it. It's like a guide for psychos. You know what I mean? For sure. It's like if you want to be a psychopath, just live your life in these specific ways. And then, yeah, I guess you can kind of be a billionaire a little bit.
But what was interesting, I mean, one scene that really stuck out to me was like, you know, as she's building this company and then she decides like, I need to get a new car, and she decides the new car is going to be a Prius. And she says, you know, that's what everyone's getting. So it's interesting, like what's everyone's getting. So there's that element, but also you're getting a Prius. So you're being very like responsible. And then as she's driving, she spills coffee all over herself and she's on the phone. And she's like, oh, shoot, spilled coffee. And her mom's like, well, don't you have a cup holder? And it, like, they never answered. Like, maybe she did get the lowest model without even a cup holder. But just things like that stood out to me where it was like she was modeling after all of these people. But then she also did seem to want to keep this humbleness. But was that humbleness, again, part of the character development? Like, I need to maintain these qualities in, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, she was talking about like Mark Zuckerberg and how he, you know, like was just coming out like in flip flops and like, you know, these like just very normal t-shirts and stuff like that. So that's the thing. They also think about themselves about like not materialistic, and they're doing this to change the world, and like they have to keep humble while also have ideas that are like, you know, I'm gonna change the universe. And I'm like, you can't have it both ways.
No, you can't. And the other part of it is, so she's at Stanford at this moment, and as depicted in, you know, The Dropout, she goes to the medicine professor, Phyllis Gardner, who is still currently at Stanford. And Gardner basically is saying like, oh, I don't think your idea is going to work. I think it's impossible. And so there's that thing of like, it's impossible, that they then warp into, well, if you think it's impossible, you're never going to make it happen. We're the people with the dream and we're able to make it happen. And they're like, well, no, physics and chemistry are real, tangible things. They have to fit within the universe of reality. You can't
You can't outdream science. It's
exactly. You can't outdream science. And this is what I like to call, and I think I've told you guys about this before, but you just transcend something. You know that there's a truth. You know that you should probably be a vegan, and that you should probably, this is me personally talking, you know, because you believe in the rights of animals, but you just transcend that notion and you just push forward in the direction that you feel like pushing forward.
First, can I say that you can't outdream science. You need to trademark that, Mohanad. I want that on a t-shirt immediately. Let's start selling that. I'm sorry, trademark. Second, but can we just talk for a second about Phyllis Gardner and the amazing casting job they did in The Dropout with Laurie Metcalf? Like, I have my own like passionate love affair with Laurie Metcalf, like ever since like she got sort of like revitalized in that show Getting On. It was like an HBO show that lasted like I think 2 or 3 seasons. But, you know, like Roseanne, like I've loved her forever. But this casting that they did for Phyllis Gardner, who is just a gravelly... just sort of cantankerous, like what you would imagine, what I would imagine like an Ivy League professor is, right? Like, but in that way that no bullshit, she cuts to the chase. She, I mean, every interview, it's her. She does not change her beliefs about Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
In her Wikipedia, I think the first line says, one of the first people that was suspicious of Elizabeth Holmes, like literally line one. But yeah, Lori is doing such a great job of it. I just want to like point that out.
That's so funny. An Elizabeth Holmes truther.
And a pre-truther too. She's like, I knew from the very beginning. No.
It'll be on her gravestone. Like, I
Which
swear,
honestly, like... is there a more feminist thing you can do? Because all those dudes that are like investing in Elizabeth, to a certain extent, they're like falling for the sort of like, they're almost like romanticizing her in some way and putting her on this strange pedestal and wanting her to be like this person or this leader that she is not and does not have the skill set to be. Versus Gardner, who literally is like a professor of clinical pharmacology and is like a crazy expert in this whole like microfluidic stuff that they talk about on The Dropout. And she's like, no, I see through you, bad woman. There's bad women too.
It's so true.
And I see it and you're bad.
Yeah, because like here's, you know, Phyllis, who's like, I've done all of the things. I never used my sexuality to give it ahead. Like I never tried to flirt my way. I did the work and you have to do the work. And I think she just felt like Elizabeth like wasn't even willing to do the work. Yeah. Like, you know, like you take a few classes and then you think you're going to start a whole company. And it's just interesting because I think that there is so much belief that that can happen because some of that did happen, right? Like people did start these businesses and you thought anything was possible. But it's like when it comes to medicine, no, there is just things that are medicine. Like you said, what is it, Mohanad? You can't outdream science.
Throughout the early childhood years, there are opportunities for every child's potential to blossom, for curiosity to spark, and for a lifelong love of learning to begin. Welcome to Lilio. We develop innovative tools that revolutionize the connection between daycare centers and families and help empower educators, enabling them to nurture young minds and build strong bonds. Through our solutions for center management, family engagement, and teaching and learning, plus professional development through Lilio Academy, where educators can earn continuing education credits at their own pace, we've impacted countless educators, children, and families. We stand as a symbol of quality and commitment to early childhood education. With the belief that early childhood educators have the power to change children's lives and ultimately the world. Join us in nurturing the future. Welcome to Lilio, the building blocks for high quality childcare. Learn more at www.lilio.com.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, the first time I ever heard Elizabeth Holmes' name, I think, was in 2015 when she was named the youngest self-made billionaire,
same, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, same. Mm-hmm.
And to learn that this company started in 2004 and wasn't indicted until, I think, 2017.
Yeah.
You're telling me that for over a decade, this woman was getting people to give her hundreds of millions of dollars and nobody even saw the damn machine. Like this, I'm sorry, this, if this had been a black woman, the chapter would have been about two pages long. There's no way we would have gotten past, oh, I need some audited financials. I need your personal net worth file. Like there would have been so many things that anyone else would have had to give to get to this point. Decade? No.
This reminds me of like a tweet that I read, which was about the Tinder swindler. Which someone, like a black woman, tweeted, and she was like, this whole Tinder swindler thing would never happen to me because thanks to systemic racism, there is no bank that will give me this loan.
Absolutely not. I was like, I kept looking at it, I was like, story would have ended here.
Yeah. And it's insane. What is the name of the doctor or the professor that did not believe in Elizabeth Holmes?
Phyllis Gardner.
Yeah, so Phyllis Gardner, like I remember, like one of the things that she was like, yeah, she was charming these old white men, and they were giving her money. And there were videos, like even in Congress or like people who are in charge of like pharmaceutical companies and stuff like that. Like they literally telling Elizabeth, you're just amazing. And I'm like, what is about this that is just so fascinating to you? Is it the voice? Is it actually working? That is the thing that is like blowing my mind. That fucking voice has worked.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using it for the rest of this episode.
Yeah.
It's insane because it does not sound real.
No,
it doesn't. And there was a study done that basically there's this thing where like it was a study I read about essentially talking about the fact of like what we find trustworthy in terms of voices. And it is true that men and women find deeper voices more trustworthy than higher pitched voices. That is a scientific fact. So I could see how based on that, people are like, wow, deep, dark, gravelly voice. That is absolutely worth. I think at the end, she ended up embezzling a total of $700 million from investors. So that's what that deep, gravelly voice is worth.
I'm going to start doing that. I know like I have a deeper voice as a man, but I'm going to keep make it deeper. You know, every time we end this podcast, I'm going to be like, hey everyone, if you can like tell people to subscribe and like we need more listeners,
please subscribe.
And, this is my Venmo if you want to send me money, and please listen to I'm Sorry. Like it's the best podcast ever. Like I think we deserve $700 million.
Oh, I'm swayed. You really got me.
Thank you. Thank you
absolutely.
So much.
Yeah.
Going to rate and review now.
Yeah. And so she basically funds and expands the entire company. I think it's like by the end of 2010, Theranos has $92 million in venture capital at that point. So she raised $6 million to start off just to fund the firm, but then 6 years later, $92 million in venture capital. And then she meets with former Secretary of State George Shultz, and then he joins the Theranos Board of Directors. And really, this is when it fully takes off, because shortly thereafter, they announce their partnership with Walgreens. And so in the show, they do a really good job at explaining kind of the difference between retail and launching in retail versus launching through Pfizer, through like the specific kind of like pharmaceutical team, because pharmaceuticals are highly regulated in ways that retail isn't. And so they launch kind of this in-store blood sample collection for their centers. And this is also when she appears in Inc. in 2014. And then they recognize her as 110 on the Forbes list of self-made female billionaires. And that's all based basically on the value of the company. So it's not like a liquid amount of money that she has.
And like I will say, like, as somebody who doesn't know a lot about venture cap, or like, I feel like I didn't know a lot, especially back in 2015, right? And like, 2017, sure. I didn't know a lot. I know a little more, but it has been this like sort of secret society thing.
Yeah.
And to learn that, you know, these companies that get these private investments don't have to have the same sort of regulation as other companies. It was like, oh, wow. Now I understand why this, because I've always called this stuff funny money. It's just funny money to me. You're telling me this company's worth $9 billion. Why? Because they don't have to prove why. They just have to like get enough people to say, I believe in this company, don't have to show any records to support it. And then they can just kind of like live that way in a bubble. And then next thing I know, the stock market's dropped, recessions hit, I've lost my job, gas prices through the roof. That's all I know.
That's when it starts to affect us. Yeah.
And people believe them. People like, if you have enough money and you like, you look like you know what you're doing, they'll just give you anything. And I think we need some diversity in the scammers world, you know, like we need more people of color, more black people who are like can just scam their way into doing stuff.
I want to be a billionaire for a few years. Yeah.
Yes. I don't want none of this little mom and pop scams. I want systemic level scamming on behalf of POC people. And I want them to get away with it.
That's what's crazy. You know, like if you were to ask like a bunch of like, you know, well, I'll say racist white people, right? Like who commits the most crime? They would probably blame, you know, black people, Mexican people, whatever. Yeah. But it's like, okay, but do we like go into the healthcare system and like completely try to defraud like them? They're getting blood tests where they think they have cancer and then don't the next day. Like that's way more harmful than, I don't know, maybe.
Or
like,
even worse, seeing that you don't have cancer and then you have it. And then only learning after it's like too late when it's like stage four or something. And you literally kill the person now.
Yeah.
Because of your dumb shit, because you think you believe in yourself.
Yeah. That's true crime if you ask me. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. No, it truly is. Like you put these people's lives in jeopardy. You killed people. That's not, I mean, sorry, like fuck your dreams at that point. Like it's just, it's about people.
Trademark that one too.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck your dreams.
And it just sucks because like this is like, you know, tech industry, startup industry, like the whole Silicon Valley thing. And I mean, like this is like present in other industries too. Like if you're in the entertainment industry and you are like as a person of color or like black person or something, you want to like pitch a show or do something, you have to just literally put your soul into it and just put so much. And then you see a show like, I don't know, Emily in Paris.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can never pitch a show like that. I'm just like, yeah, Woman in Paris or just like fucking, I don't know, hanging she doesn't out. Know what she's doing. They'd be like, fuck yourself.
Oh my God. Yeah. And tying this particular thing back to kind of like the downfall in particular is like, she's primed to, in some ways, like almost like just the full 10 years to go by and for her to get her technology. Like it's almost like she just had to make it far enough, but couldn't. Like the technology was too far away for her work, for then her actual actions and for the meat to catch up with all the talk that she had put into it. And so,
I mean, was the technology far away or was she just living in sci-fi the whole time and it was never going to be possible? I mean, that's what's even more insane to me.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about it more in, you know, as we break down the court case. But as I understand the court case, they really make a case for that distinction. Like that is what that distinction is, what the court case is really all about, is how much did she know? Was she doing it intentionally? Or was she really a person who was, you know, on her way to this thing that she was promising and then sort of lost it along the way? But this particular moment, she's kind of at her height. And then this is when the John Kiriru and the Wall Street Journal initiate the investigation of Theranos. And he received a tip from a medical expert specifically who thought that the Edison blood testing device, which shows up in the show, was suspicious. And then Kiriru ends up speaking to all the ex-employee whistleblowers and obtains company documents. And this is when she's being at her most secretive, really. So she really is trying to avoid this from coming out. And, you know, reveals that they had been using like commercially available machines to do the job that they were saying that the Edison machine was doing. And then used just a huge amount of kind of strong arm tactics and legal, you know, threats in order to try to stop the article from coming out. But this is when we really get into Holmes is denying all the claims. She is, you know, she goes on Mad Money the day that the article from the Wall Street Journal is published and is just basically like goes through her regular spiel. When everybody doubts her, she's like, well, this is what the status quo wants to do when you're trying to disrupt a, you know, a billion dollar industry or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, and her quote was, and then she goes, first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world. And in that all of a sudden, I just laughed so hard at that quote because just the words all of a sudden, it really reminded me back to Phyllis Gardner, where she's like, do the work. It doesn't happen all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It cannot happen all of a sudden. And, but she's still at the height of it, is using that language to describe it.
Well, even her line in the article that was being written about her, where she was referred to, he said it was comically vague when he was describing, you know, walking through and seeing the lab. And that's what set off the investigation by Kiriru, I believe, is like reading that like comically vague. Everything about her is very vague.
Like, I think that she really believed that this is going to work eventually.
Yeah, I think, you know? So.
Like, yeah. I don't think that she was like, I want to defraud people and hurt people. But at the same time, she was just like, I am willing to do anything for this to work. And that is the problem, is that you think it's work. And if, you know, if you sacrifice few people in the way, that is for the greater good. And I think that's the problem that people think about, is that they, like if you hurt few people in the way to the greater good, whatever that is, because they believe that they can do that, then that's fine. You know, it's kind of like the trolley problem, you know, like one person or five people. Like, I sacrifice four or five people to these experiments, but I'll save hundreds of lives.
Yeah.
But I also feel like that is the reason she kept Sunny around. I mean, you know, her and Sunny hid their relationship for what, like 12, 13 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting, you know, in The Inventor, which was the HBO, you know, original sort of documentary before any, you know, any of the cases had started.
Yeah.
They were talking about this like lie detector test that they were doing with DICE, this behavioral analysis guy. And saying how, you know, when people roll the dice and you don't ask them what they picked and then they're to reveal it afterwards, you know, they always end up, you know, getting it right. But of course, the lie detector picks up that they're lying. But if you change the dynamics where it's like, okay, if you roll this dice, a charity that you want to get money gets money. Even if they're lying, it doesn't show up on the lie detector test because they believe if they're doing something good.
Yeah.
It's not a lie anymore. And I feel like that's part of the reason she kept Sunny around so long, because he fawned over her, right? She wanted people always who were fawning over her.
Yeah.
And because he was never going to doubt her and he was just going to be like this echo chamber back, she started being able to just convince herself more and more, because she's like, as long as this guy is telling me it's okay, then it's okay. I'm not doing anything wrong. And I think she probably could pass a lie detector test because she legitimately thought she was still doing good.
Yeah. She incepted herself, essentially.
Yeah, and if there's anyone I should trust the judgment of, is the man who's dating a woman 20 years younger than him.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah, that man is like has sound judgment.
Met when they were 18, and he was just the only adult in this.
Jesus Christ, yeah. And she was like, yeah, this is the man that I think has a very good judgment. Mm-hmm. Let's go for it.
Agreed. Well, I'm excited to cover her relationship with Balwani, how it shows up in the court case, and some of the more like explosive things that happened while she was on the stand. This is a really interesting court case, and it kind of spans relationships, healthcare, drama, there's babies, there's marriage. I mean, I swear to God, I feel like the court case is really exciting. So I can't wait to talk about that next week.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Okay, now it's time for my favorite segment of every week, which is Sorry Not Sorry, where we either apologize to someone or have someone apologize to us. And I'm going to start with Oha. What's happening this week?
Well, I would like to apologize for being a hater. I was a hater in this one particular occasion. I'm a hater at many points in my life. Big judgmental person. Even though I don't say anything, I have many judgments inside of my head. I'm so sorry. I'm working on that. But I have a couple of friends, and they were very good friends of mine. And they got together maybe like 4 years ago, and they got married over the weekend. You know, they had a very small wedding, very far away, so I couldn't go. But when they first started their relationship, I just had flashbacks of me actively being like, that's never going to work out. Like, I was so... such a hater about their relationship because I thought he was much more interested in her than she seemed interested in him. And I gave him so much bad advice. I said so many things that's probably just absolutely not true, but I'm just very happy for them that they made it through my haterade, pushed through the doubt of all of their friends and family, and have like an awesome relationship. So yeah, just shoot the messenger sometimes. I was a bad messenger, and just do your thing. Don't listen to me, you know?
I will never listen to your advice if that helps. And I never did in the past, too. You know?
I know. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
To have friends that you don't listen to. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they made it. You know, that was their, I don't know.
Honestly, the odds are against them and for me. But
You still want to win.
Yeah. No. Bless you guys. You're going to be amazing. You're going to be together forever. Mm.
Okay.
I've heard that.
Okay. Kiki, what's do you have something, you know, less hateful?
A little bit less hateful. I think I'm going to apologize. I think I'm going to offer a future apology to everyone. I don't know how long it's going to last, maybe for the next few months, for everyone that I complained to about gas prices, because like this is the first time I've had a car in a long time. And California already has like really expensive gas compared to like everyone else because supposedly they have additives in them. So they like increase the price. I don't really know. But there's like one gas station that always has really cheap gas. I think I've talked about this before and I said like, oh, it's cheaper gas. Maybe it doesn't make my car go. But, you know, it's the cheapest gas.
Yeah.
It's never gone above $5, which is like pretty normal in California, like a lot of. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go there because they never hit above five. And this weekend, driving by, over $5. And that was when I was like, it's over.
See, here's the good thing about living in New York City. I have no idea what the gas price is. And here's the thing. There's a gas station right in front of my building. Like, I can literally look out of the window and see the screen, and I have never bothered because I'm not paying for the subway train to move.
Yeah.
So I don't care. I don't look at it. People complain about gas prices. I'm like, I don't know, move to New York. Here's a crazy idea. I mean, just coming from me, maybe more public transportation, more money should be put in public transportation. This is just me being crazy right now.
It's a wild idea. That and electric cars, which are totally feasible. These are two completely out there ideas.
Yeah. Well, I don't have anything this week that is as, you know, as insane as gas prices or wishing people break up for my own, you know, so I can feel bad about myself. No, I'm honestly, it's a very small thing, but you know, like when you go to a restaurant or something and they keep, you know, like when they come to you and ask you how's the meal going, which is nice, you know, they do it. You're like, it's going great. Even if you still haven't tasted it yet, I'm like, this is awesome. Amazing. Thank you so much for chicken. I was doing a show at Union Hall last night and then I went to a Mexican food place right by it. And I swear, like no exaggeration, if maybe 7 times a different person or like the same person would come to us and just ask you like, how's the food going? Do you want drinks? And it's just like, I am here for food. Please leave me alone. Like they kept like going at us like to the point where I'm like, you know what? I want to check. I just want to leave, really. Like I don't want to drink. Why is it that complicated?
Oh my God.
I wonder if they got like a really bad Yelp review and the managers were like, you need to make sure that you check on all of the customers because we can't have bad services on our Yelp review.
And I get it. And I honestly think people who, you know, like leaving a Yelp review is one thing. Like sometimes like you have such a bad experience that you just have to be like warn other people, you know, it's to that point. But, like, you know, there are, like, people, like, who leave Yelp reviews to any place that they go to. And even though I believe in abolishing prisons, I do think, as we still have prisons, these people should be there. Just locked behind bars. Because, like, if you're just, like, that's a hobby you have where you, like, just, like, leave Yelp reviews. Because it does stuff like this where it affects the rest of us who just are not complaining and just want to have a good experience. And it's why Uber drivers, like, they feel like they have to talk to you because other douchebags are just like, 3 stars, the driver did not acknowledge my existence. And I'm like, no, that's a 5-star experience for me.
Yeah. You're such a harsh punisher, Mo. Like, you're just like, you really, truly do not believe in a comeback arch. You do not believe in, you know, the resolution of the human spirit. You truly are like, jail these people forever. I'm done. And I appreciate that.
I believe in the human spirit of the people in the customer service industry. And I think people who, because I worked in customer service, and I think if you are making these people's lives any harder, you truly deserve nothing.
Right. I will say that, like, I was an avid Yelper, but it was positive reviews only because I wanted to counteract a lot of these service, you know, related reviews. And if it was a small business, I wanted to make sure people knew how good it was.
So, no, that is good. Yeah. No, I think that's literally that's how it should be done. Like, if I have a bad experience somewhere, like, usually I'm just like, okay, personally, I'm never going back there.
Yeah,
and that's it. It's so simple.
Right.
If I like it, I want other people to go there, so I'll just, you know, I'll review it. But the whole thing about going into like a doing a bad, like, I don't know, maybe it was my experience, maybe it's like on a different day someone will have a better experience. Who knows?
I will complain if it's like atrocious. Like, I, you know, if you go through my Yelp history, which now you probably will. They're like, they're, I remember in particular that it's like I went into like a beauty supply store and the person behind the counter refused to take my credit card. And it just felt very racially motivated.
Wow.
And I just felt like, you know what?
Yeah.
You're getting a review. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going to keep sending people, you know, so I will do it, but I get it. Like, I should just sometimes I just have to let it go. But sometimes I just can't.
Okay, where do you guys stand? And if you get a meal or something that you don't like, do you send it back? Or are you like, I ordered this, it's what seemed good to me, I have to eat it?
I will return, not like every single thing, but like overcooked meat, I will return. Things that are cold, I will return. If it just tastes bad, I generally don't. I'm just like, no, that was bad, you know, like, because it's probably going to be just as bad the next time. Like, the chef doesn't know what they're doing.
That's what they intended for it to be bad. What about you, Mo?
I don't think I've ever sent food back, really.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm just,
it's
know.
The scariest thing in the world to me. I just I'm like, okay, maybe this isn't the place for me. I get stressed out when I have to return a dish.
Same,
I hate it.
Same, yeah.
Truly hate it. Can't think of a thing I hate more right now.
Other than happy couples.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like it. Oh, huh? I mean, hey, it's okay.
Hey, I thought this was a safe space to be an asshole, okay? And now I'm getting called out again.
Yeah, well,
I already came to the table with my apology. That should be done now.
You thought wrong.
I'm Sorry is a Lemonada Media original. The show is produced by Alex McCohen. Supervising producer is Chrissy Pease. Our executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax and Jessica Cordova Kramer. Our mix is by Kat Yore, and theme music was composed by Xander Singh. If you like this show, please rate and review. And please don't cancel us. You can find out more about our show at Lemonada Media on all social platforms or follow us on Instagram at @I'm_Sorry_podcast. We'll be back next week. And until then, be nice, play fair, and always say, I'm sorry. Thanks for listening.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jose Andres. Maybe you know me from my restaurants or maybe from Wall Central Kitchen. the organization I founded to feed people after disasters. Well, it's time for you to know my podcast, Longer Tables. Each episode, I get to know fascinating people in the most intimate way, through food. Stacey Abrams, Jojo Ma, Jane Goodall, Padma Lakshmi. I will answer questions from listeners too. Join me in building longer tables, not higher walls, whatever you get your podcasts.